This conference will now be recorded.
This is Monday, February 9th, 2015. Tonight, this is the Reading Odyssey Aristophanes series, and tonight we're discussing clouds. On the phone, I've got Nano Karma, Nancy Copan, Stephen Stout, Alan Davis, Millie Cave, Zach Morowitz, Nicholas Chorin, Bill Swislow, Scott Thompson, Tony Tree, Sean Buddy, Josh Kirshner, and myself, Phil Terry. And we may have a couple more people join us. So thank you, everybody, for calling in tonight. I've been looking forward to this. I thought I would ask Scott Thompson to just, set a little initial context for us. And then I want to ask as many of you as we have time for in terms of your favorite passages in the text. I often like to start there, and then we'll move on from there. All right, so but Scott, can you just take a couple of minutes and remind us the context here of comedy and theater in Athens? And
this is a very, very superficial look from a person whose knowledge is pretty superficial, but the plays that we're reading were originally performed in one of two Athenian festivals, the Dionysia, which took place in the spring, and the Linnaea, which took place in the winter. Both festivals were in worship of Dionysus, Greek drama. Both tragedy and comedy comes out of Dionysic worship. You see this in the plays themselves, in which you have a large chorus and a small number of actors, and the structure of these plays came out of an earlier sort of stage of celebration in which you just had a large chorus singing and dancing, and then you started adding actors to that. And in fact, the larger the two festivals, the Dionysia, began the first day was still that old fashioned, just, a chorus singing. Of the two festivals, the Dionysia features tragedy more prominently, but five comedies were performed at both of these festivals, as far as we know. We don't know any of this for sure. Apparently it was cut down to three at times during the Peloponnesian War. So, to say you got a third prize was to really say you finished last, at least, if it was during that time period. The plays were paid for by wealthy Athenian citizens who were selected by the state. And that was an honor that they competed for, but it involved a very considerable expense to them. That's just sort of they were performed as part of these huge Dionysian festivals in Athens. I just wanted to touch briefly on something that really struck me, which is how huge a part of Athenian life these plays must have been. The population of the city, we estimate during the time that the plays that we're reading were performed, was probably around 300,000, of whom no more than 30,000 to 50,000 were citizens. The Athenian assembly that sort of ran Athens, was the ultimate legislative body, apparently never had more than 5,000 or 6,000 people in attendance. But you would have 14,000 people coming to each of these plays. So, somebody like Aristophanes addressing contemporary concerns, was a very, very prominent voice indeed. And Phil, unless there's anything else, that's all I had.
Okay. Okay, good. That's helpful. All right. Well, let's and I know some of you may have read that in the intro, but I just wanted to sort of remind ourselves as we jump in here. So let's talk about favorite passages from The Clouds. Maybe it's something you thought was particularly funny, or maybe you were touched by, you like the language, whatever the case may be. So let's see. Who would like to start us off? Anyone have a willingness to begin us?
This is Bill. Yeah, so. I have one I could share.
Great.
It's line
then. Yeah.
Yeah, it's basically line 975, where it's a passage earlier on. I'll tell you about the way boys were brought up in the old days, and then he talks a little bit about that.
Yeah.
But then this passage that begins, then in the gymnasium, when they sat down, they were expected to keep their legs up, well up so as not to torment us with desire. And when they got up, they had to smooth down the sand so as not to leave any marks on it for their admirers to feast their eyes on. What's more, they never oiled themselves below the belt, and their privates looked like peaches, all velvety and dewy. And you wouldn't see a boy being his own pimp, walking along, making eyes at his lovers, and putting on a soft, tender voice. Oh, no. I mean, the eroticism of that, you know, especially like the marks in the sand, and just the, you know, how alien that is to, you know, until the last, or would have been until the last 20 years or so to modern ears, is just pretty striking.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have a passage. This is Nancy. And actually, yeah, that was one passage that I had underlined, so I'll go to a different one.
So I went first.
Well, it was a great passage. This is around line 1065 or so, and this is where they're right and wrong are arguing, and Wright says, is talking about Peleus and his virtue, and he says, and it was also because of Peleus's virtue that he got Thetis as a wife. And Wrong says, yes, and that was why she deserted him as well. If he'd had a little less, if he'd been a little less virtuous, he might have been a little more satisfactory performer under the covers. I thought that was just hilarious. I mean, it was like, I was like, Paul Lynde could have played the role.
Yeah. You'll have to explain that to me, though. I didn't understand that line. I'm joking.
Well, hi, this is Stephen.
Yeah.
By the way, Kendall sends her regrets. She was naughty and didn't read the play, so she's not with us tonight.
Well, we only accept virtuous people on this call.
There you go. Well, here's what I'm touched by as a theater teacher. To me, this is so much naughtiness in terms of being able to diss Socrates and sort of some of the legends that we now think back on, and we look at the way this has played out over the years. I could probably write a huge lecture and or term paper about starting from, you know, Molière, Goldoni, Farquhar, Brinsley, Sheridan, Shaw, Wilde, even David Ives, looking back. This is how it all began to me. The fact that we in the public place can give, we can kind of knock on our sacred cows a little bit and make fun of how the humans deal with these people who are up on pedestals. It reminds me a little bit of Jan Kott, the eating of the gods. The whole idea of, you know, we put these people on a pedestal and then we kill them, kind of like Nixon with Watergate. It's yummy to go back and at Aristophanes as a precursor of the allowance of this kind of social commentary that has prevailed since in wonderful writing.
Stephen, it's so great to have a theater teacher with us as we read. So thank you. Remind me, what are you teaching theater in high school or college?
High
or
school.
Community?
High school. No, high school. High school. Yep.
Okay.
I'm a school theater teacher after having been an actor for almost 30 years.
Could your students assign them to read this, or is it too naughty?
I could assign them to read it. I don't think I'd want to produce it just because I want to really go there. And then I'd be fired, and, you know, I want to make it to my retirement without that. And 911, all of that sort of scares me.
Yeah.
But I could certainly read it. Right now, interestingly enough, right now, my students are in the process of just having finished Molière's School for Wives, and now we're reading Tartuffe. And these plays, you know, Molière was jailed for Tartuffe. It was actually censored for 5 years. And yet the king kind of dug it, and he allowed it to go forward because he realized that this was good for his society on some level, I think, my one man's opinion. But to me, this is one of the things we do in the theater. We hold the mirror up. It's sort of the Archie Bunker thing. Are you this much of an asshole? Well, if you aren't, then you get by. If you are, then look at this. Take a peek at this. Are you this bad? Is this how weird you are? Is this how you don't, you know, fit into to our idea of what culture is and society should
be? Yeah. Did you have a favorite passage, Stephen, that you wanted to share?
No, I have to admit, I'm kind of thinking of it holistically, and I love specifics so far that have been said, the two that have been said, because I'm in violent agreement with them. But I didn't.
It's so interesting
Go ahead, Nancy.
That you said Archie Bunker, because I was thinking, and maybe some of it's a translation, but you can only translate what's there, actually, that it felt kind of, the pacing felt sort of like a 70s sitcom in a way. It just felt, you know, or like the banter felt like that, partly because somebody would say something and, you know, then it was countered in a certain way. But it sort of, I don't know if anyone else had that sort of feeling.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and it was originally done in 1973, so there you go. I mean, that was part of it, to sort of keep it edgy and real. But then I'll back out a little bit to talk.
Yeah.
This is Nan.
Right.
I found was, I thought it was, it's almost like a comedy of errors and not quite a farce. It didn't quite get so far into farce territory, but it was, yeah, all these puns and play on words and plans going awry. And
hey, Nan, let me just interrupt a second. There's somebody who's, there's like a lot of sound in the background. I don't know if somebody's like cooking dinner or doing something. Okay, sounds like it's maybe
doing
stopped.
Something. Stop.
Yes. You should only be listening and listening. Yeah. To us. Okay. All right, Nan, go ahead.
Just about the, you know, plans going awry and you know, thinking you've got it all figured out and it all gets turned around on, it almost seems like everybody, like no one really comes out well in the end. And the one passage I couldn't find when I was just looking for it, but it was, I think it was the chorus, and they were like kind of warning the lead character that things are going to go wrong for him, and he's like not listening, not paying attention, and that just reminded me of the typical Greek hubris, almost, where the hero has his downfall.
Hey, hang on a second, man. I'm sorry. I don't know what's happening. Are you guys hearing this loud noise?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I don't know if someone maybe is brushing up against their microphone, doesn't realize it, but it's difficult. So seems like it's paused. So all right, Nan, keep going.
Just the Greek kind of hero always has his downfall because he ignores the gods or doesn't listen to the gods or thinks he can outsmart the gods, and that just seems to be the traditional ending here.
Yeah. You're right. It's not quite a farce, but it sure did almost go there, didn't it? Almost. At moments, anyway. Okay.
This is Sean.
Yeah, Sean.
If I can jump in. I was impressed by the timelessness of fart jokes. like that.
Yeah.
That's striking to me. But I do have a favorite passage because I felt it was the most, I don't know, like, purely timelessly comedic, and this is Socrates when he's explaining why he hangs in his chair above the ground.
Yeah,
he says, "Had I pursued my inquiries from down there on the ground, my data would be worthless. The earth, you see, pulls down the delicate essence of thought to its own gross level. as an afterthought. Much the same thing happens with watercress. Like, I don't...
In modern random terms, like, that just struck me as a very... In fact, that was timeless. That could be a Judd Apatow movie now.
That's good. And sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the humor in it, across it, could all of it could be in a modern movie, and the same sort of the fart jokes, the body humor, that could all be in a modern movie, and it would sound completely contemporary.
Yeah.
Well, this is Stephen again. You're making a case for my business to live on and do well, and I think you're right about that. I really do. And to think of this as something that somehow got dragged from the times of the Greeks to modern day through all these great writers, including Shakespeare, is truly remarkable to me. And that's how I like to look at this play. And all
Yeah.
Like an Apatow movie, you know, it's like it's body.
Yeah. Yep.
It's still funny after 500 years.
Is that Josh?
Yeah.
You want
that sort of amazed me. It's just that I really expected it to be a lot drier, and when I read it, I'm like, wow, this is actually really fun.
Mm-hmm.
Did you like a passage you want to share with us, Josh?
Yeah, there were a couple that I really liked. There's one that I thought was really clever from a language perspective, which was line 1010.
Yep.
And some of this is probably the translation, but I think he's trying to be true to what was really said here. It says, if my sound advice you heed, this is Wright making an argument here for why Wright is right. If my sound advice you heed, if you follow where I lead, you'll be healthy, you'll be strong, and you'll be sleek. You'll have muscles that are thick and a pretty little prick. You'll be proud of your appearance and physique. If contrary-wise, you spurn my society and turn to these modern ways, you'll have a pale complexion. With two exceptions, all of your limbs will be too small. The exceptions are the tongue and the election. And I love that pun at the end, where you
yeah.
see the audience thinking he's going to be talking about something else being larger, but he's already talking
yeah.
about an election.
Yeah.
And it reading yeah. back in the notes, you know, the original
yeah.
language there was saying it wasn't an election, but it's essentially a long decree, but the same idea that, you know, that these people will be turning to successful politicians and making fun of politicians and that. But I just
yeah.
love the language and the pun there that was used.
And what I have to say, you know, reading, I'm assuming most of you did read the notes, because when you read the notes, it's so clear that they're, is so much more going on. I mean, it's still what I agree. It was funnier than I thought it was going to be. And we're missing a lot of the jokes because there's wordplay that had very particular meaning in the ancient Greek that doesn't completely come across in the translation, though the notes help to point that out. Cool. All right. Zach, first of all, is this your first call with us?
Yeah.
Have you done? It is. And how did you hear about the Reading Odyssey?
Well, I was reading Herodotus a few months ago and was somehow banging around the web looking up something about Herodotus and came across the Herodotus reading group.
Ah, great.
And
great.
So then when I saw you were reading Aristophanes, especially starting with the clouds, it was irresistible because I read a lot of Plato when I was in college, and I was very familiar with the Apology and Socrates
Symposium.
Talking about Aristophanes' characterization of him in the clouds, but I never actually read the clouds and found out what that was. So it was fascinating to actually get that firsthand.
Great. And Zach, where are you calling in? Some of us have been doing this together for 7 or 8 years and have known each other quite well. So we're thrilled when someone joins us like you have. Where are you calling in from?
I'm in very snowy New Haven, Connecticut.
Okay. All right, Stephen is in Connecticut. Stephen, where are you? What part is
Snowy Southport, Connecticut.
Ah, Snowy okay. Southport.
Yep.
And Zach, do you mind telling us a little, what do you do, you know, when you're not reading Herodotus and Aristophanes?
Well, I am a retired management consultant, basically. I was in corporate strategy and corporate communications, and I was a speechwriter, and then I had my own consulting business, basically focusing on CEO leadership, and I'm recently retired, so I have time to do things like read Aristophanes.
Who did you write speeches for, Zach? Political speeches?
Well, I was actually, and you'll find this sort of relevant and peculiar, I actually studied not only philosophy in college, but I also studied rhetoric. So I'm very familiar with the Greek sophists. And part of having studied rhetoric led me to partially having a career in speech writing. And I wrote mainly business speeches. I worked for a company that focused on information technology research, and I wrote speeches for the CEO there.
Okay, great. Well, welcome. Thank you. Do you have a favorite passage you'd like to share with us? Or
I didn't have a particular passage per se. I go to a lot of theater, and I thought the opening sequence in this was, and this is reading it, not seeing it performed, just even reading it, was one of the best and funniest and sort of quickest openings I've ever come across. You have a sort of beleaguered, harried father with a free-spending son and a social-climbing wife and debtors banging on the door. And as other people have said, it's beyond sort of contemporary. It's immediate, and it's just, you know, I was just amazed how accessible and easy it was to get pulled in. And it was just amazing writing. Very funny.
Yeah. Yeah. Excellent. Great. Well, again, welcome, Zach, and thanks so much for joining us.
I'm very happy to have discovered you.
All right. Tony, is this also your first reading group with us?
No, it's my first with your group, but I first ran into Reading Odyssey when I was, like Zach, I was sort of tootling around on the internet, and I was very interested in Darwin. I always have been fascinated by Darwin. And this was during the sesquicentennial year. I forget which one it was.
2009. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Cool. Anyway, there was a discussion group on that, and I joined that, and I really enjoyed it. And I've been kind of looking for something else I was interested in, and this was it.
Fantastic. And remind us, where are you calling in from?
I'm in Nacogdoches, Texas, where it is about 75 today.
Awesome.
I was out in my t-shirt in the woods, sweating.
Will you host us in person for our next session?
Oh, sure. No problem.
We're coming down.
Just remember your tick spray.
Gotcha. Is there a favorite passage you like?
Actually, there were two that really tickled me. One is by Socrates. And about line 296 or 7, where he's chastising Strepsiades for kind of goofing off and saying something funny, like, I need a crap. And Socrates says, no buffoonery, please. And what I really liked was, you're not acting in a comedy now. I enjoyed the irony of that, and I was surprised to find that kind of self-referential comedy in something that old. Maybe that was common in Greek drama, but I wasn't familiar with it that long ago.
Yeah.
And then I like the very last couple of lines. Lead the way out. We've done, I think I'd say, sufficient choral service for today. Just amusing the way it was worded.
It is amusing.
Much better
right.
than Aerosmith's wording of it.
That's great. Well, thanks, Tony. Good. Let's see. Who else? Alan, how about you?
Yeah, I enjoyed the political satire in his, and I guess to segue back to what somebody earlier said, as lawyer jokes have been around thousands of years, I guess is what I really netted out with. And the I didn't realize Athens was that litigious, and litigation was that important to them. But I guess. But I enjoyed his call out to Cleon and that Athenians always make the wrong decision, and it's the lines that begin about line 580, and it's where the leader of the clouds is talking about how. How the clouds try to guide Athens, and it's the one that he goes on before your high command invested that Thessalonian tanner. We protested with knitted brow, we thundered, lightning flared, so on. And you elected Cleon just the same. Athenians always make the wrong decision the first time around. We gods, though, make provision to see you get a second opportunity to rectify your blunders with impunity. We tell you how to do this time, too. Get Cleon charged with theft. That's what to do. And he continues on. I mean, what a shout out to the political leadership by this comedian that, you know, Athens just muddles its way through to success.
And some things just haven't changed, have they, Alan?
Do they have it?
Well, one of the things that's been, as you know, an ongoing theme in our discussions over the years, whether we're reading Herodotus or Thucydides, or we're reading Plato or passages of Aristotle that we could comprehend, which of course was not necessarily very much of it. Or others is this notion of how much our technology has changed, but how little our human behavior has changed. and that was one of my favorite things about this whole play. Not just the humor, although I'm with Sean. I just can't believe how good I remember watching a movie recently and like, where did this fart joke stuff come from? And how come it's so damn funny? But we've been finding it funny, at least men, I guess. Women maybe don't find it as funny as men. I don't know.
Bill, if I may ask, what film were you watching? What film are you talking about?
I was trying to, I don't know. You know, I'm on a book tour right now. I'm actually, by the way, I'm in Napa Valley speaking to you from a spa here where I'm speaking at a conference. So I am not in the snow of New York and New Jersey and Connecticut, but I switch on the. And I was in Boston a couple of weeks ago for the bad blizzard, the travel ban day, the whole thing. I was so I'm glad to not be up there. But so I turn on the TV late at night, and often there's these bad movies that I watch for a little while. So I don't know I can't remember what it was. But I just remember thinking, this is so bad, but it's funny. And I love that about this. Not just the humor, but also the one of my favorite passages was around line 330, a little bit later than that, Socrates is speaking on about how you're not aware that they give sustenance to a vast tribe of sophists, high-powered prophets, teachers of medicine, long-haired idlers with fancy signet rings. And, you know, I often get frustrated with how much baloney there is in the business world and how much jargon and bogosity and business speak and consultants who speak about nothing. And of course, in the political world and other worlds as well. But this has just been a part of, are seemingly part of human civilization for just a very, very long time. And it's, some of the fascination with the new, just because it's simply new, and the neglect of the old, which Aristophanes takes swipes at different points, as well as the the line about the gnat's arse. Do you guys remember that?
Yeah.
Yes.
There we go, back to fart jokes and related, you know, bowel movements of different kinds. All right, let's see. We haven't heard from everyone, though, and there's a couple people who've called in who I don't know yet are on the line. So who's joined us? A couple of you.
It's Andre. I was a little late, sorry.
Andre.
Yes.
So good to hear your voice.
Good, thank you. Same to you.
Yeah. And who else? One more.
Brian.
Brian. Oh, okay.
Yeah, Brian from Ohio.
Okay. Hello, Brian from Ohio. Okay, good. Well, Andre, what about you? Talk to us about a favorite passage of yours.
Well, there were some real passages in here that weren't translated. I have a different translation. It's the Moses Hadas translation. And
do you also have it in the ancient Greek?
No. I think this is probably some of the hardest Greek ever. So I am not even going to even try that, you know.
okay.
So I remember that part about the flatulence,
yeah,
and how it kind of made noises and stuff like this. And it reminded me of something in Finnegan's Wake. And I think it might have been a note that tied it to this particular play and this particular reference, but that's been a while since I've looked at that. I did hear a lot about Cleon. That's when I kind of came in, and that was really interesting to me.
Yeah.
I really, really thought that was interesting. And then the way that, okay. I'm looking at near the end where the son gives the dad the business, basically. And
Yeah.
And he calls him some things. It's really
so different. Andre, what do you have three boys. What do you think? Should your sons be able to beat you up when you're
Well, they already do, so they got the jump on me. Now, I won't let him read this, okay? Until, you know. yeah, this was really good. That I think that's what got me the most is the end here where Pheidippides is saying, "I'll prove I was justified," and then this is I don't have line numbers on this, but it's a couple pages from the end, and they're calling each other names. Strepsiades is saying to his son, "Scoundrel, parasite, burglar." Pheidippides says, "Say it again and more. I love being called names." And then Strepsiades says, "Rammed bottom," which I can only imagine what that is in Greek. And then Pheidippides says, "Strew me with roses." And then Strepsiades says, "Beat your own father," and says, "I'll prove I was justified." And then he goes into it all. It's just it's just really interesting. I kind of saw what was coming at that point, finally, that he was going to really twist things around. But
so this is Sean again. Like, was anybody else really struck by the end? Like it was all kind of humorous and light, and then he's burning shit down. That kind of freaked me out. Like, I'm just curious about.
It's all in good fun.
Yeah, it's gonna
right. Like, just the last two pages, I'm just burn the place down. Did that hit anybody else oddly, or not? That was just me.
Yeah, this is Stephen. It seems sort of to be a screech to the end. It's like the brakes got hit really hard right there in terms of the writing. Yeah. And all of a sudden we're done. We're just over.
The audience is filing out.
That sort of like tied into the passage I liked the best, which was around 400 when Socrates is explaining the natural world, and he's explaining that things like rain and thunderbolts have natural causes and don't come from Zeus. Mm-hmm. And you know, I couldn't, I was, when I was reading that, I was thinking to myself, well, you know, he's right. You know, Socrates is right. There is no Zeus, and these things really do have natural explanations. And I wonder if, and I bet Aristophanes knows that. I bet he knows that Socrates is right. But I think his, where he's coming from is that society will fall apart if these beliefs go away. And that's why he brings that's why he shows the play ending in violence, because that's what he thinks putting aside the traditional gods will lead to.
There was also that
footnote I sent around from another translation where the guy says that the burning is really, it's actually a mock model of Socrates' entire natural universe. I thought was a pretty interesting insight, if true.
Yeah. I agree. I thought that, I did think, Sean, that it seemed like hard breaks and, whoa, we just moved in a different direction. And I thought it was possibly insurance to be sure that the gods would not be angry at Aristophanes or the Greeks for putting on such an irreligious play. So I think that sort of fits with what you're saying. But there was also a part of me that thought, you know, there were a couple points in this play where it went in a completely different direction. And part of me also thought, well, it's just, okay, here we go down this road, and burning people alive and up on the, although I was wondering how long he was going to be able to stay up on the roof there until he fell in himself.
This is Nan. The one thing that I thought about that, it's almost, to me, it was like all talk, no action. Because on line like 1490, it starts.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to make this lot pay for what they've done. It'll take more than big talk to save them this time. So it's almost like he's going against the sophist thinking and saying, talk will only get you so far. If that's all you do is sit around and think and talk, you have to do as well.
So for you, the outrageous nature of the act was itself making the point that action was required. Fair point. Okay.
And then also I thought that, again, a couple of like play on words where he's like, let's light things up. Mm-hmm. When he goes to light it, kind of, and maybe again, it's the translation, but let's get things started, but also let's light the place on fire. And then later he's saying, I'm chopping logic with your rafters, of course, you know, when he's using his axe on the stuff. So it's, again, it's all in that play on words and kind of puns and double meanings and.
Yeah.
How I took it, at least.
Millie, I don't think we heard from you on favorite passage or just general impression of reading the text. Do you want to jump in?
Well, and I was thinking about my favorite passage was actually around 7:45. It was just the section where the Socrates and is trying to get the father to like come up with how would you not pay your interest? How would you not pay your debt? So he comes up with this plan. Suppose I bought a woman slave from Thessaly, a witch, and got her to draw down the moon one night and then put it in a big round box like they do mirrors and kept a close watch on it. What good would that do you? Why, if the moon never rose, I'd never pay any interest. Why not? Why not? Reckoned by the month, of course. So, and then he says, very good. What a great plan. Let's just put the moon in a box. And I love the way it's just like this outrageous thing. It's like the Bugs Bunny farce, you know, where Bugs Bunny is going back and forth with all these with all these ridiculous things, twisting it. And it just seems like the best idea. That's a great idea. And it's just encouraging outrageous plans that people take, you know, take in stride as being what you should do. And I kind of thought that played into the end because the action was so big and large and sort of building on that idea of being humor and the outrageous. I mean, burning down and ripping up the roof and so on. It didn't feel like it was meant to be like a literal thing. It was meant to be big and outrageous and found the humor in that.
Yeah.
And that's why I like that.
With monthly interest, no less.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And that's why I love that whole sequence where he's in bed, he's being eaten by bed bugs. And that's to inspire him to come up with these fantastic plans. So I found that to be just lovely and funny.
And by the way, this is your first Reading Odyssey group.
It is.
And why don't you tell folks a little bit about yourself?
I'm here in Columbus. And I'm really excited to be a part of this group, to read this play and to hear other people's ideas on it. I think it's wonderful.
Great. Okay. So, Sean, do you want to talk some more about the end? Do you feel like we responded somewhat to what you had to say there?
Yeah, I guess I see the point.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I guess in a way, it almost feels like one of those Saturday Night Live sketches that they can't figure a way out of. Or like, if Monty Python wrote it, a big foot would just come down on them all and it'd be over.
It just like felt a little... If you think of Into the Woods, it's like Sondheim, right? With the giant.
Okay.
Yeah.
Into the Woods. Yeah, it was just a little bit... I can see the point of like maybe... how you were building there, how it was metaphorical, all that. But it was harsher than anything else. Like bed bugs are an annoyance, but they're not fatal. Right.
Yeah.
And suddenly it got real serious real quick, and that still is jarring to me.
Yeah.
Hey, Sean, this is Alan. I had I think we were warned a couple of times that this was not going to have a happy ending. If you look at in lines where the course talks in 805, they tell Socrates, make your profit fast, bud. Favoring winds ere now have shifted. Luck will always last. And I kind of thought,
I kind of thought
the burning was kind of clever. And it took me a long time and a lot of reading of another translation to understand the charcoal kiln that sits outside Socrates' house. That represents
his
view of the universe. Now, all of a sudden, and that's heat up above. Now, all of a sudden, the old gods are coming back and saying, okay, we'll burn your house down from the top. So I kind of thought it was kind of clever.
Yeah, okay. I mean, I guess I saw the end where the son turns on the father. That made total sense to me. Like, that struck me as it's obvious that from the start, I don't even know how to pronounce his name, is not going to win, right? I mean, I think that was obvious. But the it turning in on Socrates, I definitely didn't see, although obviously given the bias of the writer, I should have.
Yeah. I mean, the way I looked at it, here's Socrates who is gaining money by doing, evil things. I mean,
so
he's a betting.
Yeah.
In helping Strepsiades.
Strepsiades, yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Socrates for a minute. So, first of all, can someone just say a few words about how did Socrates end up being the one of the key characters in the play here, or what was going on? Anyone remember from?
This is Brian from Ohio.
Yeah, hey, Brian.
Well, at the time he wrote this, this is, 423 BC?
Yeah.
So it's during the Peloponnesian War, and Socrates is somewhat known. I mean, it's, 24 years before his death. But as a aristocrat, he would have been in constant... competition or tension with the Democrats at the time, and they were always going back and forth. I mean, that's why they're always installing Kleon in the Democrats. And although it wouldn't be until, what, 411 BC that they have their first oligarchy, you know, there's still that tension between the aristocrats who are trying to teach people how to be clever so they can move up the social economic ladder or so they can avoid their debts, as opposed to the aristocrats who want to pay off their debts according to their morals. Well, maybe in general, you know, or at least the right thing should be to do to pay off their debts, because it's the moral thing to do.
Right. The other thing is that Socrates is, let us not forget, in this play, he's in charge of the thinkery. You know, he's not a teacher, but he's like, he sort of oversees the whole thing. And they have a very materialistic take on the world in the thinkery, it seems to me. And so Aristophanes is having a lot of fun with this, and surprisingly amounts of fun with it. According to Socrates, the gods don't exist, right? I mean, isn't that what he's kind of doing here? Am I wrong, folks?
No. Aristophanes, in the play, the character Socrates says the gods do not exist. Yes, that's very, very right. And why do you think...
Oh, go ahead, sorry.
No, Nancy, go ahead.
This is separate. This is not specifically about Sophocles, but just I think it's so interesting, you know, the theme of this, to learn argument, to learn rhetoric that can do away with debts, the power of language to be able to change the course of one's life. It's sort of a fascinating concept. If I can just learn this skill, my life can be completely turned around. And the appreciation of language as as an art and as a skill, I mean, here, you know, then to be used for unethical ways. And then, of course, this is a play, which is created through language and acting, too. And so I just thought this whole notion of the power of language was also something that really struck me.
Great point, Nancy. Thank you. That added something to my reading of the play.
Absolutely. And it makes me think of something else, which is any plays that aren't current from any classic play, you put these plays in students' mouths or anybody's mouths and let them speak them, they take on a whole other kind of reality than when we sit and read them as archaic texts. And as you can see with this translation, which is very modern in many ways, as we've talked about, this thing just jumps off the page and it makes me want to do, you know, a lively reading of it with students to get the thing even more alive. And it goes back to your idea of language and rhetoric. To me, put it in the mouths of people, and you'll get even further with this. That's, I guess, what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's a really, Nicholas here. It's a really interesting point, because so much of what the ancient Greeks wrote was meant to be spoken, right? So if there was something written on carved into a block of stone, they expected people to stop in front of it and read it aloud. Like, the difference between the written language and the spoken language is really, really narrow. And I'm wondering if that's why it comes through so clearly to us today, because even though it's in translation, this is something that was meant to be said, and so it would be sort of odd if it didn't resonate with us, because these are real people, real concerns, and, you know, speaking the things they're worried about.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, so it's like Simonides' epigram for the Spartans, right? About how, you know, stranger passing by, I can't rhyme it off the top of my tongue, but, you know, when you read that out loud, it just hits you right in your stomach. It's, you know, just the power of the words after all these years.
Yeah, read the Gettysburg Address aloud, and it will jump off the stone.
Yeah.
Is it the go tell the Spartans that we lie here in obedience to their laws?
Yes, that's it. Yeah. Exactly. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's fun to see, you know, the power of language and they and he speaks along the way of it. So he says language with the fire burning and the action happening at the end, but in the end, language changed his life, and language is considered not. So he, in the end, lights the place on fire because the argument and the words, you know, need to be stopped. Yeah.
Our translator argues that Aristophanes was hoping to be taken seriously and to have an impact on Athenian life, culture, politics. Do you, you know, we talked about that we laughed and we're talking about language now. Did you read this play and did it provoke some thoughts on any of your parts in terms of what was he saying here? What was he attempting to say? What was he hoping to achieve with this? If beyond laughter, what do you think was important to Aristophanes?
That's a really interesting point. It's Nicholas again. I mean, one of the things I was struck by was Strepsiades as the farmer. And right, this is the, you know, the wealthy farmer as the foundation of the hoplite class in Athens. This is a huge, you know, this is the Clisthenes reforms back before Marathon that turned Athens into a world power. But at the same time, this whole class of people, you know, these sort of these rough bumpkins who aren't well-spoken, you know, simple men who live by the old ways, you know, sort of those Aesop's fables and all that sort of stuff, those sort of old ways of life, are running up against this educated class in the city, both from the aristocrats and then the new men, the rowers of the Athenian navy, who were really the source of power. Right, it was the mob that the speakers would go to rile them up and get their votes, because the Peloponnesian War made the rowers into a voting class with incredible power. And so there's this whole cultural dynamic in conflict here, and it's being borne out in just two different ways of arguing and thinking about what's right.
And is Aristophanes, from what you can tell in the play anyway, independent of what you may know of him otherwise, is he taking a side?
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure if he is. This is a weird thing, you know, because knowing about him from outside, he and Socrates got on okay, right? They could go to dinner together and laugh with each other and tell funny stories. So,
yeah.
So, you know, within the context of the play, he's clearly antagonistic. But was he really, or was he just sort of running out this sort of civil disorder or this conflict in Athenian society that could potentially tear it apart and tear down the House of Athens?
Yeah, and
Aristophanes is not necessarily saying Socrates is a bad person, but he certainly is sending him up a lot. You know, he turns him into a disgruntled person about Strepsiades being so ignorant, and he's very demanding and harsh in his tone, and he's kind of I don't know, he seems to have no humor in this play, Socrates, and so. How can you divorce that from anything that Aristophanes might be kind of saying about this great personage?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Alan.
All right.
As I look at the way he portrays Socrates, it's almost as a stock figure. I mean, because he attributes, as I understand it from some of the footnotes, a lot of things to Socrates' philosophy that Socrates never really believed. It's almost like he's using Socrates because he's recognizable, easily characterized, easily made a caricature of, and he's using him as a stand-in for all of the new fast-talking, glib lawyers that are invading and changing and subverting Athenian society. So I'm not sure it's a true attack on a personal attack on Socrates, as opposed to using Socrates as a stand-in for a whole class of people.
So is it an attack on rhetoric itself, or rhetoricians, or?
Well, the sophist, that's the term they're using. That's why I think that this is really a slam on the rising use of of lawyers to settle disputes and all that, which always, you know, which raised in my mind is there's something about democracies that generate a need for a large a lawyer class to adjudicate complex laws.
Yeah, this is Brian. I think part of what happens in democracies is that everybody's concerned about their individual rights, including their property rights, so that, you know, the laws become more important, where in something that's not, you know, anything that's not a democracy, it's not quite as important because simply your rights just aren't there.
To me, too, there was also, it was almost against the sophists in the sense that it was lack of accountability, or against again with the laws, that they could argue their way out of anything. So what good are the laws, because I can just argue that I didn't break the law, or that the law doesn't make sense, so we need a new law. And it was almost like people just kind of wanted to do what they wanted to do and not be held accountable. And they were just going to come up with a reason why what they wanted to do was okay.
Yeah.
It almost gets down to a discussion of, you know, who determines what's right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, this is Zach. This is ultimately the problem, and the ultimate problem with democracies is it leads to a complete moral relativism in which the majority rules. And I think that's a lot of what, you know, I think that's a lot of what this play is about, which is, you know, Athens was in the midst of this real intellectual revolution, and I think Socrates is sort of a poster child for that. And, once you sort of open things up and let the majority rule, you end up with what? With this sort of moral relativism. And not to, you know, fast forward several thousand years, but the U.S. founding fathers were adamantly opposed to setting up a democracy. They wanted to set up a republic with a constitution to avoid this sort of moral relativism, where it was always just ultimately the will of the mob that decides the direction of the country and the community.
Well, let me just jump in and say that I'm sure that each of us on the call has some different, you know, political perspectives on democracy and what the founding fathers did or didn't want and what it meant in ancient Greece. I think I was trying to ask what did you think Aristophanes was saying, whatever our individual opinions may be. And, you know, we're close to an end here, so I think we'll wrap up, but we'll do this again with Liz Estrada. You know, what I want to encourage is, as much as possible, there can be differences of opinion on what we think Aristophanes is doing, or what he seems to be attempting to do, and whether he succeeded or not. But I'd like to try to keep it within those parameters, at least until we've had some good discussion about that, and then we can elect, of course, to talk about implications for the modern era and what we think it means about democracy or not. But there are some nuances here, and I'll just end by saying maybe in a future call we can discuss where we think Aristophanes is coming from, where we think he's coming from in placing the words he's placed in Socrates' mouth, what we know about and then independently what we know about the historic Socrates, and whether he, you know, because he was accused, of course, of supporting the oligarchy and undermining the morals of the youth and undermining support for democracy later. And there's something about the way that Socrates retreated from a battle in the Peloponnesian War and the disdain that he showed for some of his fellow Athenians and the way they retreated. In other words, he didn't like the way they retreated, like basically ran quickly away. And he actually seemed to have showed some courage, but he was also disdainful. And there are some who think that that's what Aristophanes was tapping into here by setting up Socrates in this play, the sort of general sense of disdain that the Athenian public at that time had for Socrates. It's a bit complex, and I'm not actually totally clear on it myself, but that's what I'd like to ask that we do. Zach, so, you know, fair enough. I appreciate your point, and let's, you know, in our next discussion, it's going to be on Lysistrata, which is a, and I think one of the questions that I would like us to struggle with is, what do we think is going on in that play? And is it, in fact, an anti-war play from our experience of the reading? Or is there a sort of multi-leveled argument that Aristophanes is himself making? And then what do we make of that? So we just a couple things, housekeeping. So the next call is, as I said, on Lysistrata. And in fact, several of us, Nancy, you and me, and I don't remember who else, saw the play at Lincoln Center 6 or 7 years ago, as I recall, something like that. And so I'm looking forward to discussing that on Monday, March 9th. So we've got a month to read it. And then, as you all know, I think we are doing a webinar with Paul Cartledge at Cambridge and Bob Mankoff, the cartoon editor of The New Yorker, in May, where we will be talking about this celebration of the 2,500-year anniversary of the first comedy introduced into the festival in Athens. That was in 486 BC. And I don't think the text of that comedy exists, which is why we're not reading it. But Bob and Paul and I had a recent conversation, and I'll tell you that Bob has studied the history of comedy, and one of the things he talked a lot about in the call was the importance of comedy in taking the piss out of leaders. And somebody earlier in the call mentioned this concept of putting these, you know, making fun of leaders. And so at least that, I think, was going on with Aristophanes. Socrates was well known, and let's take the piss out of him. But I think there were at least a couple other strands there. So good. So it's 9:05 Eastern time, 6:05 West. And so I think we'll conclude. Are there any parting comments? Was there any additional comments somebody wanted to share before we...
The only thing I wanted to share was, I was just really surprised. It was like line 653 when he's talking about sticking out his middle finger, and that it was not mean and contemptuous gesture. I was amazed that it was that old. I don't know if anybody else was, but I was.
Yes, me too. That was fabulous.
Well, and, you know, they don't have a translation issue.
Right, I mean, I think that was the interesting thing to me about this versus a lot of the other stuff we've read, is the translation here feels like it matters a lot more, right? To capture comment.
Yeah.
I think I read a different version than many of you did, but like,
well, there was a note on that. There was a note, an end note on that, and I believe it did in fact indicate that it was middle finger. And
hey, really? Okay.
Yes.
I take it all back then.
Yeah.
All right. Good. All right. So Lysistrata next. We're reading the translation for Lysistrata that we've chosen is the same Summerstein translation. Now, for those of you who aren't reading it, as much as possible, if you can, at least get a copy, because it's helpful for referencing line numbers and that kind of thing. But, you know, whatever, that's up to you. And then we're going to read Lattimore's translation of the frogs for our final session. But thank you very much, everybody.
Well, thanks, Phil.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks, Phil. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The organizer has disconnected, and this conference will continue for...